leave it at that. The introductions for our panelists are all in the program as well, but I'm going to let them introduce themselves here and tell you a little bit about how they got into official scoring and whatever else they want to say before I have a few pre-prepared questions, and after that discussion, we'll go to the microphones and see what kind of questions everyone has in the audience. So with that, I'll pass it on to whoever wants to do. You want to lead it
up? I'm Stu Thornley, and I've been doing official scoring off and on since the early 1980s, and I got into it because I was doing public address announcing at things, and sometimes they say you're going to be the official scorer too. And then did it with the Minneapolis Loons, and I was doing official scoring there and public address announcing, but not at the same time, as they kind of went together. One time I did a radio play-by-play for Ryan LaFever, and who went on to better things, and doing official scoring. And with no replay, it's kind of tough. If you don't take your eye off one time and looking down and trying to do play-by-play, you look up and the ball's going by the third baseman, you call it an error, and then told afterwards that it was obviously a bad hop. So it's nice now we've got the replay, we've got all of that stuff. We had our meetings. First time they ever got official scores together this year in New York, and one of the goals is to standardize calls so we can have as much consistency. We all hear the word consistency a lot. We have to be consistent, and it helps. We discussed different situations, and we looked at 56 plays last year that had been sent into the league office for appeal. About 18 of them had been overturned, and we all got to watch these together, and that's a big help. Just to try to zero in on some types of things and what you call them. But after each play, we'd raise our hands if we thought it was a hit or an error, and we'd be told what the scorer's call was and if it was upheld by the review committee or not. And brought it back, I know Greg took the list and he watched it and marked off. And a lot of the scorers were saying there was a lot of disagreement among us. And to me, it's not surprising. Because I think, while it's good to try to standardize things and get consistency, I think people have to accept the fact that there are a lot of plays out there that there's going to be widespread opinion among qualified people on whether it's a hit or an error. It's so subjective. It's not like, was the guy safe or out at first? You can put the replay on it and slow it down and see whether the umpire made a correct call or not. We've got the replay there. We have people hovering over us, watching. We're watching the same thing. It doesn't matter what angle we look at it. We're just going to have disagreement on it. And I think that needs to be accepted, that it doesn't matter what you do. They're subjective, and they're going to be calls that could go either way. You have very qualified people who have different opinions on it. So I appreciate it once in a while where a PR person from a team will just say, well, it's subjective. The person might have disagreed with me, but said, well, it's objective, just acknowledge that. Those are the 50-50s that we call them. They're the ones that we get paid to make. One thing, doing this at a major league level, you don't have as many calls to make because these players are so good. And you do this at an independent league level and the same plays don't get made, and now you've got to make a decision. And you might have a number of decisions in the night. And here we can go many games without having anything come up. I think that's the way it's been this week. But we still see these plays with that ground ball and the shortstop's right, and we're thinking, oh boy, here we go. And he makes a play and gets the out, and we say, boy, thank you. Mike McConey, you all watched the end of Roy Halladay's no-hitter in the playoffs. Remember the last play, the ball got top, and Carlos Ruiz pounced on it and threw from his knees. He said, Carlos Ruiz is my hero. And apparently Mike would have called it a hit, but was sure happy that he didn't have to. But at the major league level, I'll say the Wander after a play where they get the out. What do you call that? I don't know, but I'm glad he got it. I say that all the time. So it's different though. When you do make a call, the pressure is a lot different than at an independent league level. The pressure is a little bit different, and I felt that the first time I ever did that for a Twins game, and I had a renewed respect for anybody who does anything for real and not from the armchair. And I say that as a person who's been an armchair person like all of us and just about everything, with official scoring, managing, general managing, third base coaching. I always think, how can that idiot do that? But when I sat in that seat with a little jitter in my hands, I tried to keep my scorecard, I just thought I'm going to give credit to anybody who does anything for real and puts it on the line. There is a difference between the armchair and the hot seat.
Hello, my name is Greg Wong, one of the twins officials for this, Stu and Kevin. I started when I was in college at the University of Minnesota. I worked in the sports information office, and my boss there said, we need somebody to be the PA announcer for Gopher baseball games. You're it. So that was my introduction. So I did University of Minnesota baseball for 2 years, and then I went on from there to St. Paul Player Press, where I was a sports writer for 33 years, covered the Twins, many of those years in there. 1988 was the first year I did any official scoring at the major league level until the boss of the newspaper put an end to it. He was concerned with any, you know, potential conflicts of interest, even though I wasn't covering the team at the time. But and then when Tommy retired in 2007, Stu and I and a couple other guys jumped in and started doing the scoring. Nowadays it's mostly Stu and I with Kevin filling in when I'm out of town usually. But Stu mentioned the 56 some plays that were submitted for renewal last year. When I looked at the tape, I disagreed with 18 of the final decisions that were made, whether upholding the call or reversing the call. And Stu and I disagreed on about 15. So that just tells you the subjectivity of these plays. Even some plays this year that I've seen were sent in, I disagreed with our calls. But you know, it's different when you see it in person than when you look at a tape, because a tape a lot of times does not show where the base runner is, where the hitter, up or down the line the hitter is. They're just looking usually at the end result of the play, and so sometimes Joe Torre and Tony La Russa, the guys in New York, get it wrong. I just like to add one other thing. People have to say to me all the time, you got to be making the calls in favor of the Twins because you work for the Twins. No, we work for Major League Baseball. We do not work for the individual teams, and we are paid by Major League Baseball, and we're supposed to be objective, and I think I know Stu and Kevin and I are. David, I'm not so sure about. You know, he had a couple of lousy teams, but now he's got a good team, so maybe he's a little better at it.
Thanks for that wonderful
My name is David Vincent.
I'm one of the official scorers in Washington, D.C. This is my eighth year in the big leagues. In my 25th year in the minor leagues, I also do Carolina League. I've worked in other leagues as well in the past. So let's just say I've put a few names and a few plays down on score sheets through the years. The first time I ever did this job was actually in high school. And I used to get paid $2 a game. I don't get paid much more now. Anyway, Dave both talked about interpretation. Here's the science, the rule book. But there's an awful lot of art to it, because no matter how carefully some lawyer writes the rule book, you can't really cover what happens on the playing field. Anyway, in 2005, I was the official scorer for the first major league game in Washington since 1971. That was a lot of fun. In 2008, I was the scorer for the first game at Nats Park, which turned into a much better game than it would have, because the Nationals closer gave up a run in the top of the ninth and opened it up for Ryan Zimmerman to hit a game-ending home run to end the game, first game. 2010, I was the scorer for Steven Strasburg's Major League debut. In 2011, I was the official scorer for Steven Strasburg's Major League debut with his new arm. And in between, it worked a minor league game of his. I've seen two presidents throw out ceremonial pitches at my games in D.C., a lefty and a righty, and I'm talking about throwing hands, not politics. A couple of plays that I've seen. In 2007, Franklin Gutierrez hit a ground ball to third base, and the ball disappeared. Bounced in front of Ryan Zimmerman and disappeared. And it took my brain a second to catch up. And about the same time the home plate umpire put his hands up to call time, I realized I had seen this. The ball went in Zimmerman's shirt. So Zimmerman was given first base. And I thought, it's going to be a hit. What else could it be? That actually got written up in Baseball Digest, I think, in the year 2006. I had a play, runners on first and third, the batter struck out, runner on first was going with the pitch. The runner on third was eventually tagged out, and the play went 2-4-2-5-3-6-5. Everybody in the infield, including the catcher, had his hands on the ball in that play. Only the pitcher didn't touch it. 2-4-2-5-3-6-5. Try to keep up with that when it's going on. My trick, by the way, is I say it out loud as it happens. And then I look at the guy next to me and say, what the hell did I just say? In 2009, I was working a game, the Astros were in town, and we were in extra innings, and it started pouring rain, and we sat there what seemed like 3 days in the rain. It was the last game of the series, and of course, since those teams are in different divisions, they only come to town once. And the game was suspended from May the 5th to July the 9th, and was completed in Houston. So, a week later, I called my boss at the commissioner's office and I said, what do you want me to do with this? I worked 12 innings or whatever it was. So one of the guys in Houston sat in the chair, kept track of how much time was played for two plays in Houston, made one call on an error, and we talked on the phone about seven times that day. And I'm the one that ended up doing all the paperwork after the game. I did 99% of the game, and they told me, well, you're still the scorer. Very strange, though. Two things this year. Back in May, I was working a Sunday night game against, it was the Nationals against the Phillies. And some brash kid got hit by a pitch in the first inning, made his way around to third base. Bryce Harper stole home on a throw to first base. Pretty exciting play. Another one of those that you have to think about half a second. And then, Tuesday, I got to watch some pine tar ejection. Which was kind of fun. I've seen, between the majors and the minors, I've had two games fogged out, I've had sprinkler delays, I've had light failures, but my favorite is a helicopter delay. Actually have. I've worked five no-hitters, all in the minor leagues. I've come close to the big leagues, but not yet. You guys work no-hitters? Earlier this year in the minors, there's a pitch in the dirt, runners on second and third, two outs, pitch in the dirt. Catcher had no idea where it was. He stood up, took his mask off, he's looking around underneath. And somebody from the dugout must have yelled and said, it's at your feet. And he reached down, picked the ball up with his mask. A lot of umpires in this room shaking their head. You can't do that. Attached equipment. It was funny because as soon as he picked it up, I said out loud to myself, you can't do that. But in the minor leagues, nobody knows anything in the press box. So the umpire looked. It was very funny. The home plate umpire standing there. He had moved away, and he's standing there. I saw him kind of cock his head a little bit, and he put his hand. Signal guy third, the runner on third, come home, and all that. The guy on third who scored had reached on a single when he hit a ground ball towards first base that hit a base runner. So I had a base runner hit and detached equipment in the same inning. Stu said something about he goes days without having to make a call. That's just Stu asleep, I think. I'd like to tell people that we're hired. You go to a big league press box, there's lots of people who can make 80% of the calls. We're hired for that last 20%. Although sometimes it seems like it's 95% some days. I had a tough series last week. Tampa Bay was in town. It seemed like every day there was something going on. The more times I have to pick up a microphone and talk during the game, the less I like it. It means there's ugly things going on. Let me know Paul White, who writes for USA Today. He sat next to me 2 days last week, and we were talking between innings, and I told him about the panel, and he started laughing. He said, "You know, I quote you all the time. Something you said to me a few years ago," and I looked at him and said, "Why would you be quoting me?" I said, "What did I say?" He said, "You were talking about Alfonso Soriano, because he got left field for the Nationals 1 year. Was pretty brutal." And I said something to Paul one night about Soriano turns more routine plays into tough scoring decisions than any player I've ever seen in my life. Delman, yeah. He says Delman, yeah. Paul says he quotes, he sees Soriano botch a ball, and he'll tell somebody, David Pinson says, at least I probably didn't say any naughty words in the middle of that sentence. So. Anyway.
Okay.
We've got an official story from Venezuela. Gil, where are you? Stand up. Come over and talk to us, and sometimes they're not nice, but I'm just kind of thinking it might be a whole different thing in Venezuela. So congratulations. And Gil had a question that he gave us here, just base hit shouldn't be scored when a batter apparently is safely and the runner was forced to advance, fails to touch the first base to which he's advancing, and is called out on appeal, charged the batter with a time of bat and not a hit. And that's absolutely correct. And of course, that's a Fred Merkle play too. Al Bridwell didn't get a hit on that, but Gil brings up when Mattingly and Winfield were going to the batting title, what happens if Mattingly would have gone on base, Winfield needs a hit, he gets it to the outfield, and Mattingly misses second base. That could have been ugly. That is just the rule. I can't tell you any more about it other than sometimes the rules are unfair.
I guarantee you no player knows that rule.
It's on, yeah. At least you could delay, don't they? I learned that lesson painfully a few years ago. The Reds were the minor league team I worked with, and that was the year they decided that no pitcher was going to pitch more than 75 pitches in one game. So what they did was they took 10 pitchers on a minor league team, and they paired them off. And it was Greg and I. Maybe today Greg starts, when he gets to 75 pitches, he's done, doesn't matter. And I come out of the bullpen and I finish, you know, I pitch, and I get my 75. And then the next time in the rotation, I would start and he could. That lasted 1 year with the Reds, but it caused me a lot of difficulties because there were a lot of guys who didn't get to 5 innings, left the game ahead, and would have gotten the win except they got pulled early. And I can't tell you how many times that year somebody came up to me and said, "Well, the guy who finished the 5th inning is supposed to get the win." No. So players don't know the rules, coaches don't know the rules. Writers certainly don't know the rules. They don't know what the rule book is.
Do you all know what forced out is? And it's well defined in the rules too. Nick Punto didn't. As it turned out, Gardenhire didn't. And I think there's a situation where Joe Torre didn't. Force off is not necessarily a play where you don't need to put a tag on it. It's got to be a ground ball and put out a runner in force position, whether it's by a tag or that. But a couple years ago, Punta was on third and Denard stand on second with one out, and somebody in the long fly to center, and Denard stand took off from second. And Punta was tagging at third, but then rather than tag and take off and run hard after the catch was made, he starts being the third base coach and was waving Span back to second base, and he loafs home, and the throw comes in to double off Span off second for the third out of the inning, but I'm figuring there's plenty of time for Punto across the plate to run the count, and he's still about 3 steps short. And Punto would just assume when Span gets doubled off, my run can't count because the third run can't score and play with the final out as a force. And a lot of people didn't know that in the press box. They were running over to ask if that would have counted. I guess Gardenhire the next day was quoted, actually, I didn't know that. The only thing I can say is Alexi Castillo wasn't on the team at the time, or else I hope he would have learned the lesson, because a year later when Castillo was on the squad, he did the exact same thing. You know, you'd think somebody would tell him. And even Joe Torre, in the 90s, game against the Mets ended where the winning run scored for the Mets with the runner hustling from third and crossing the plate. There was a fly ball and the runner doubled off with the third out. But the run had crossed and the game ended, and Joe Torre came out and had to be advised by the umpires that's not forced out and a run can't score on the play. So we just have to know the rules and sometimes explain them to others, but a lot of times even the ones on the field don't know that. And I think Wonger's exactly correct too, that Matt Don Mattingly probably wouldn't even know how he could have gotten a bad intent to do that.
One more thing related to that. A lot of people have asked me, how do you get this job? Well, you have to know the rule book, first of all, and how to interpret the rule book. And then you have to be in the right place at the right time. I think most of us have worked in the press box before we started scoring and just sort of moved into the spot.
Yeah, MLB has no qualifications. I mean, they just say you will have to witness a lot of Major League Baseball games. And that's why most of the scores today and forever have been baseball writers. Most. So that's sort of how I got it. But plus, you know, knowing somebody. I knew Tom Meade, the Twins PR guy, who did it for about 18 years after he retired. And I had done it part-time in 1988. So Tom knew I had some experience doing it. He thought I would do a good job. I don't know why I did that. But Tom recommended me, and I'm glad he did. It's a very intense job, but it's something I enjoy anyway.
You're leading me into my first question here, which is, maybe I'm stealing it from that people out there, but it's the armchair scorer's favorite question, which is, since you all seem like you have a little gray hair like I do, so you probably date back to 30 years ago. Do you think that there's less errors being called today than there were 30 years ago?
Well, I think one of the things, they changed the wording in the rule book several years ago to the point where it now says if there's any doubt, you favor the hitter. If you have doubt on the call, favor the hitter. It says that in the rule book, where it didn't many years ago. Plus, what you also have nowadays, which didn't have years ago, you've got instant replay. Any type of play that's a little iffy, questionable, TV runs it five times. And so everybody becomes an expert by seeing it on TV.
For sure.
The errors have gone down because you can just look at it. In the 60s, there were about 1.75 errors combined for both teams, and now it's about 1.25. And I looked that up because before the first game I did with the Twins, Patrick Royce, and a Cervic reporter came up to me and he said, "You know, my son researched this and said there are a few errors today, and he can't attribute it all to better fielding." And I just took it that he was trying to work me a little bit, Tom, the previous scorer. I don't know if it's necessarily a fair reputation, but he had a reputation of being a little easy in calling hits, and I just took it this is just some writer trying to work me to call more errors. But I eventually got curious, so I looked that up, and it is. So we've got about half an error per game less than when I was a kid. And so the question is why? Is it better fielding? And that can go both ways, because better fielding can increase range and put players in a position to get errors when they otherwise wouldn't have. But I think the players are better. You're probably going to have more accurate arms. And I'm not defensive about it. The overriding opinion of everybody we talk to seems to be that we're softer. The official scores now are softer. They're giving out hits on what official scores wouldn't have given out along 40 years ago. And that may be the case. I'm not defensive about it. We've got to try to make our calls along the line of what other scorers are doing. But I'm not necessarily ready to accept that as being the case. What are people doing? They're remembering plays from 40 years ago and dicing that through their mind, and that's dicey. And you hear from people, I'm old enough to remember when if you touched the ball, you got an error, and I say, you must be 80 years older than I am, because I don't remember that. You know, that's kind of, that ball, if they touch the ball, it's an error. You know, you got a shortstop diving and it goes off the club, that's not an error.
The one thing I wonder about, though, and I have no way of doing this, is that it seems to me one real skill level that we see better, probably partly for equipment, partly for proficiency, is the ability of first baseman to dig throws out of the dirt. And how many errors do they save their infielders when they do that? We see that all the time. That throw comes in and it's not dug out, there's going to be an error on the guy who threw it. And it's just, from my own dicey memory in the 60s, I don't remember these guys picking those things like they do now. And it's not just your gold glove first baseman, that's pretty much standard for first baseman. It might be the glove too. Well, if you're talking about half an error per game per team, it's like, I think that's, the first baseman today can save one error every four games, that accounts for the difference right there. So it might not just be unofficial scores. That being said, it could be that things have gotten a little easier. And we call them like we want to, and then we can get overturned on it too. I think we've all had error calls either changed or amended this year by the review process too. So we're having to zone in not just on what we'd like to call, but what we think the overall standard for it is.
Along those lines, in the minor leagues, well, in the big leagues, coaches and players aren't allowed to talk to us. This year, the PR people aren't allowed to talk to us. But they still do, correct? But in the past in the minors, I used to hear the same song all the time. Because I try to call, regardless of uniform, regardless of anything, scoreboard, uniform, doesn't matter. It's a hit or an error, or whatever. And I used to hear all the time from home coaches, we get screwed on the road, and now we're getting screwed at home. So my answer to that was always, oh, so you think somebody in another city doesn't do his job correctly, so you want me to do mine incorrectly to make up for him. Oh, no, I'm not saying that. Okay, conversation over, and I'd walk away, you know. But now, if someone starts to get a little edgy with me in the minors, I make sure they understand that I'm a big league official scorer, and their attitude changes. Magic.
You know, it's not just in the minor leagues either. We hear that occasionally. Twins people say we get screwed on the road and you guys are screwing us at home. So it's not just in the minor leagues, so that happens. One other thing I'd like to add about why I think fielding is also, or why there are fewer errors, the condition of major league fields these days is so much better than it was 20 years ago, 30 years ago. If you rarely ever see a bad hop anymore like we used to in the old days. I mean, they manicure the infield grasses. The infield dirt is so perfectly manicured, you rarely see funny bumps and bad bumps anymore. So they're playing a perfect turf as well.
One more. I had an internet question before the conference, an email question about shifting. There's been a lot of shifting of the infield this year in particular, and we've had some games where outfielders came in to play the infield, and the question was basically, how do you guys determine when somebody, a ground ball is hit to someone there, how do you determine who's in the place to score
them? The rule is actually pretty clear on it. If players switch positions, then you switch their positions. If a player comes in from the outfield, that player maintains the same thing. We had it this year where the Cubs brought in the left fielder and planted them on second base, and I was really just hoping for a 5-7-3 double play. That's what we mean. And we'll just make the announcement that Mather is still playing left field even though he's here. And then finally, when they did it again, the Cubs did it again, they switched their center fielder who was playing the left fielder and the right fielder, and then we had to announce that as an actual position switch. We've had it where when Jamie Carroll was in Cleveland and as Kubel Cabrera got hurt and they put Johnny Peralta from third to second, when they were doing a shift on Morneau, they didn't just shift everybody over. Jamie Carroll would come from third base, move around the shortstop, and play on the right side of the infield between the second base and the shortstop. The shortstop was still in that shortstop position. That was just a shift, so Jamie Carroll was still the third baseman. It wasn't a position switch, so we just go by the rules. It's really pretty well defined, but the question does come up,
for retro sheet or anything else. I mean, I think somebody had asked that. What the hell is this going to do when you see that 5-7-3 double play, or something with the third baseman playing on the right side of the infield has done it? And that's not our problem, right? So we'll leave it to Dave and all of that and how they maybe want to, with the FX fielding and all that, that's probably taken care of somehow. One thing, just as a not an official score, but somebody who grew up keeping score, you don't have to put everything in symbols on the board. There's places to write notes, and I'll write a little note in there that the third baseman was shifted over this way. And I suppose I'm game play by play, especially that's being generated by a database. And record sheet will do that sometimes. They'll go in there and put comments in. I don't know if they'll ever change the rules or how they change them, but it's still going to be confusing.
Hey, I just want to stick this in, though, before I have to give up the room here. But July 17th, Boston and Minnesota, 1992, when the Twins had brought in, or Tom Kelly at that time had brought in Puckett to play third. He had Reboy at short and Knobloch at second for this. What he did for when Plantier came to bat is he had her. Wait a minute. When Tony Pena came to bat, he had Puckett move to second base. He had Reboy move to the third base position. He had Knobloch move to the shortstop position. Now that's similar to that shift, isn't it? With moving Carroll over.
Retro sheets on top of that one.
Triple up. Yeah.
You'd have actual position shifts every game.
So in this case, when it's not a shift, then they have to do position.
If someone is
wanting a retro sheet like 4 or 5 times.
If someone's worried about who fielded the ball, the numbers will tell you. If someone's worried about where was the ball hit, well, like Stu just said, we don't care. That's the end of who's on first, right? I don't give a darn.
I remember that thing where Kirby was at second, and the question in my mind was, at the end of the season in the official scoring and fielding statistics, would Kirby be shown as having played second base?
Yeah, Dana's question was, would Puckett be shown as playing second? Yeah, he was. And what Kelly was doing was moving him between the left and right side, depending on the hitter. One that I had come up with a Metrodome, and they used to bring up the official lineup cards, and for some reason they don't do this at Target Field, but somebody would bring up the lineup cards, we'd look them over, make sure the batting order was the same. If it's not, we'd shut up, because we can't alert the teams to that. They played the White Sox, who were starting Scott Mesednek in left field and Dwayne Wise in center. And that was on the sheets that we get before the game, which are just the pregame sheets. So Mesednek in left and Dwayne Wise in center. And then they bring up the lineup cards, and I look down it. And Ozzie Guillen had listed Mesednek in center and Dwayne Wise in left. Well, they're sitting on top of the first, they haven't taken the field yet, and then they came out. Mesednek was in left, Dwayne Wise in center. And I had to go to Barry Fritz, the MLB.com game day person, and say, the official starting lineup is Mesednek in center, moving over to left field to start the bottom of the first inning, and Dwayne Wise going the opposite way, because that was the official sheet. But I've since seen on the MLB site that they wiped that out. I don't know what the rationale is. I don't really care. This wasn't a batting order thing. It didn't affect anything. It wasn't a DH thing, just a positional thing. But with what was handed in, if you say center field on it, I said, well, then he starts the game as a center fielder, even if he lines up and left.
You're lucky if you get to see the official sheet. Did you see what happened the other day in the Miami game? Cardinals manager tried to make a substitution, put his pitcher in a different spot than the 9-hole. I think he wanted to put him at 7. And the home plate umpire wrote down 5th. And it caused a little confusion. No, it was Mike Matheny, who's the manager, and he said, well, I told him 7, but I told him going in the third baseman's place. Well, third baseman is 5, so the umpire wrote him down in the 5th place. Umpire, by the way, was Bob Davidson. Not that that matters, but... After the game, Matheny said, well, I wrote it in my 7th spot on my sheet, but I should have watched him write to make sure that we got it the same.
Yeah, I think we're ready to take questions from the floor.
Okay, I'd like to lead off with actually two questions. I think American baseball fans, I know a lot of people around me. One of them I saw on MLB Network, and Harold Reynolds expressed a lot of people's opinion. Harold Reynolds doesn't like defensive indifference, which would, when he used the example of a game that was, you know, just an example of the game's 3-2, guy steals, there's guy on third, guy steals second, guy goes to second, they call it defensive indifference, and the batter hits the ball, and the game's changed. They win the game. The game's changed because of the, you know, spill on second base that the runner didn't get the time for. What you guys...
Well, I never call defensive indifference in a one-run game because that run is going to be meaningful. Defensive indifference really comes up when the final inning and the team has leaded more than one run and a runner on first base doesn't mean anything as far as a run by himself. I was surprised. The rules are pretty clear, but at the league meetings, or the scores meetings in New York, we actually had a breakout group just on that and discussed it. The rule's been around for a while, but it hasn't been applied that way in a while. But the whole idea of defensive indifference, it's not like a catcher gets a pitch that he can't handle, and rather than take a chance on throwing it away, he holds on to it. There's no such thing as catcher's indifference. It's defensive, and that's a total package of a first baseman not holding with him, somebody not covering. That's a matter of the team in the field saying, we want to focus on getting the batter out. We don't care about the placement of this runner. 3-2 game, I don't think it ever called for defensive indifference.
But it does clearly say all of what he just said. Catcher makes no move to throw.
Right.
They're not holding the runner at first. No one covers second base. There were no attempted pickoff throws to first base. All of those things
right.
Say, you know, in a game that's not close.
Okay.
But, you know, we don't write the rules.
Right.
We just have to do what it says here. There's a rules committee, and they're the ones you should talk to if you don't like it. Everybody in the room can write it.
I mean, the second one is pop-ups in the outfield. I got it. Both of them got it. None of them got it. Falls in between them, and it's a double. There's no error called it. It's an easy out.
We've seen that a lot. Turn your field in the middle. You can give an error. If it's clear. Say now, short pop up to right, second baseman goes back, he's got his back to the infield, the right fielder's coming in, clearly the right fielder's ball, but they're both going and they both stop. You could do an error to the right fielder if he was in a position to make the catch. But more often than not, those I got it, you got it, ended up being base hits, just because sometimes as well, we can't penalize mental errors.
You could call it.
So far, most often it has not been called.
We at our meetings that came up because scorers hate giving a hit on that. We all said this is where the team error obviously would benefit us. And the consensus at that meeting was that this, and we're talking about two guys, Clarence and Gaston, or whatever that expression is, looking at each other. Clarence Gaston, Cito and Gaston. I remember a couple of years ago giving
a hit. He wasn't a history major.
I know. Giving a hit, and it was the first hit of the game in about the fourth inning. And, like, you know, I didn't get any crap on it. That's just how the way it is. We all decided at these meetings, we want to call an error. You know, pick somebody, let them fight it out. We're not talking about two guys running hard and pulling off and letting that ball drop and screwing it up. But that was supposed to be conveyed to the team PR directors, and I don't think it ever got out. And we're all feeling like, unless that's really established by the league office, that our scores are going to start calling us, we're still a little hesitant. We're still a little hesitant to do that. We hate doing it. If there's ever a team error, we can do it. And if it's really communicated clearly that when two guys just pooch a thing, you know, you can't get half an error, that we'll give it to somebody. One other thing that came out of the league meeting, I don't know if we'll ever see this, but we're going to buy the official score calls the first lunch. And to me, the rules were a little bit ambiguous on this. If a guy drops a fly ball on the warning track and it falls to the ground, you know, it's a routine play, we'll call it an error. But if he drops the ball in a way that it bounces over the fence, well, the rule book in the plain rule says that's a home run. It doesn't say two bases. I think if it bounces off the fielder and over the fence in foul territory, it says two bases. But if it goes off the fielder, whether it's Conseco's head or a routine fly ball, and you can have that as like whatever, Anaheim or LA, where you got a short fence. And the question, yeah, Fenway, where a guy just can't. And the question is, by rule, could we call it a four base error? And I think it's rule 609 on the batter defines it as a home run. A home run, by definition, is a hit. Well, John Lombardo of Elias was there, and he finally gave us the word. You can call that an error. We're talking, if you think the guy should be charged with an error, if he hits his glove and falls to his feet, you don't absolve him of an error because it went over the fence. So that's the Elias ruling now, and we all are going to buy lunch for the first official score, whoever calls that, because we know he's going to be besieged.
Yeah, the guy, you're going to have really big ones to make that call.
Official score can influence the outcome of the game. I do official scoring for the Timberwolves, and it's a lot easier until you realize that you can, if you screw up official scoring there, you can affect the outcome of the game. We can affect the outcome of the game in baseball, but with this ability to call that an error on that, we could influence the outcome of the final score. If you got a game tie from the bottom of the ninth with two out, and the guy hits one in the center fielder and has to go off his glove and over the fence, if you call it a hit, well, the final score is four more runs. If you call it an error, only the first run gets the score. So that'd be the one way that we could influence the final score. But not the outcome.
Not the outcome. Actually, you could, because can't you, on a home run, can't you send in a replacement runner if the guy, you know, let's say he gloved out his
We can't do it.
But the team
can
send in a replacement runner on a home run.
Right.
If you call it an error,
will
the team
then
be allowed to send it?
Then you go back to the plain rules on that. And that's what John Lombardo said. He said 609 is a plain rule. The scoring rules are 10. It contradicts a little bit. But if we call it an error, they would still, I'm sure, still be allowed to send in a replacement runner.
I'm sure, because
yeah. The plain rule says it's a home run if it goes off the player and over the fence. We're interpreting it from scoring rules, and I got big ones, Rich.
Hey, if that comes up, I'll buy you lunch.
The issue about opening lineup, the player never plays a position, does he get credit or not, is a rule that changed. That's how Garrett got a game at shortstop. That's how Chris Short became a left-handed catcher. But the rule was changed, and now it doesn't matter what position you are in the starting lineup. If you don't actually take the field at that position, you don't get credit. And Reggie, you call that a chism, because twice Earl Weaver on the road batted a left-handed hitter named Chism, as once as a shortstop and once as a catcher. But neither time did he take the field. They had expensive sub format. He batted at the top of the first. And
what
so those
change?
No longer.
Pardon me? When did that change? What year? What year did that change?
I'm not sure exactly what year it changed.
So that's why the center would still be listed as a left fielder taking the position on left.
Yeah. Right, only left. Only whatever he actually took. So it's between the time Short caught in 61. And Chism was 73 or 74.
Nowadays, if a player, well, let me use my example last week. I had this happen. That pine tar business. Relief pitcher comes out of the bullpen. The opposing manager asked the home plate umpire, I want you to check his glove. So they took the glove and found the pine tar under the little strap. Big gob of it. He never threw a warm-up pitch. Never got into the game. Never threw a real pitch in the game. In fact, never threw a warm-up pitch on the field and was ejected. So the rule says
And I had to call Elias to make sure they understood what happened. He gets a game played in the batting statistics, but no game pitching. Because he didn't pitch. But he was announced into the game.
One time, Gene Locke had Dave Bolt's batting cleanup as a designated hitter because he didn't know whether the other team was going to pitch a left-handed or right-handed pitcher, and he knew Bolt was the one player that wouldn't play. So Bolt would presumably get practical game played.
You can't do that because you have to bat your DH once. Once, unless there is a
pitch. This is playing rules. We're not here to talk about
right. Yeah, you know, what we're talking about is like, you know, what we would do is just enter that pitcher and let the statisticians later on determine how they're going to handle it.
That was on the scoreboard prior to the game, so it was presumably not on the lineup part.
So it must be true. But in the case of a pitcher like this, or if he gets hurt. He throws a warm-up pitch and he gets hurt, he never plays in the game. He doesn't get listed in the pitching statistics on the sheet that gets turned in. Only in the batting statistics. With no position and zero defense.
What about Larry Young?
Larry Young.
That was 40 years ago.
Yeah, that's not today. I'm not worried about the rules from the...
I guess I would check with Elias if that ever came up. This is something that's more of a statistical thing than... but it is in the scoring rules, so I'm always curious about a consecutive game playing streak. You've got to play a half inning on defense or come to bat. Not pitch running won't do it. But if a player is ejected from a game before such player can comply with the requirements of the rule 1023C, which is this rule, the player's streak shall continue. That sounds really weird to me. Like, if you're injured and you can't play, if your consecutive game streak is ended, instead of the Yankees having Gehrig bat first and play shortstop, they could instead bring up the lineup card and MF the umpire, and he's ejected, and that doesn't stop the streak. So that doesn't really determine official score, but it's in the scoring rules.
A whole new understanding to Iron Man. Next question.
Tom Ice from Cooperstown. I had the privilege of being the official scorekeeper for the Oneonta Tigers for 10 years. Probably my greatest work was getting Curtis Granderson's numbers and making him most valuable player in his rookie year. We also had a perfect game throwing and a reenactment, an exact reenactment of the Merkel boner in those 10 years. So it was a pretty interesting 10 years. Then they went to Connecticut and left me alone. I'm now working in a college summer wing bat league. And I have to say that between the New York Penn League and the Summer Wing Bat League, you'll see just about every conceivable situation. First of all, I'd be interested in knowing how many people in the room have acted as an official scorekeeper at any level. If you could raise your hand, it would be interesting to see. There are quite a few more people here who actually had the experience. They may not be working scorekeepers, but I think it's something that Sabre people are certainly have an affinity for. It's been a great part of my life, and here's my question. In a perfect game situation, Guillermo Moscoso got 27 batters out of the New York Penn League a few years ago, and on the last batter with one-strike, two-ball count, the batter fouled one off weakly down the first base side towards the fence. And our first baseman that year was not a particularly agile or artful and graceful fielder. Took a stab at it, and it was too shallow for him to get to, and it fell close to the fence. And, of course, this is the only error in the book that doesn't create a runner right away. But you're required by rule to call it right away. You can't look at the instant replay, which we didn't have anyway. So everybody in the press box looked at me, and I didn't call it an error under those circumstances. But had I called that an error, on the next pitch, no runner was created because the third strike was called and the game ended. But had I called called it an error.
Still an error.
There was a big debate that night as to whether that was would have been a perfect game.
Perfect game is not a game without errors. A perfect game is a game without a base runner.
Right. And under one scenario, had the pitcher been the player who dropped that ball, and it had been called an error but not created a base runner, there would be an 0-1 on the scoreboard, and I think your answer would be the same. It's still a perfect game, even though the pitcher gets charged with the foul ball error. No? You think in that case...
The pitcher is not charged with an error, but it was the first baseman would have been charged with an error.
I'm changing the facts. Pitchers do go after foul balls occasionally, and they do drop them in the New York Penalty. They don't do that in the majors. That's the difference.
Pitcher errors are no different than fielders.
No, I agree. But there were those who disagreed, and we
need to work. That's part of your job as official scorers to educate.
Just the other day in the summer woodbed, they lost track of the pitching count. And a batter went to first base thinking he'd been walked. And the runner on first base took a stroll down to second base. And then the umpires called him back. The guy on first, they called him back and said, you haven't finished batting yet. It's not ball four, it's a 3-2 count. Then the question was, what do we do about the guy on second? Well, in that particular game, they gave him a stolen base.
If we could keep it, because of the size of the line, if we could keep it to one comment or one question for first, everybody, if you want to cycle around, that's fine until we get to talk.
Question on the charging outfielders with errors on fly balls, and I remember when Stu had gone to that Yankee White Sox game in Chicago, and there was a no-hitter, and Stu came back with a level of consternation about the fact that an outfielder had been charged an error, worse to the effect that it wasn't done very frequently. And so I've had some subsequent discussion with Stu on this, and it arose again when Mike McCoy was playing right field for the Blue Jays in a game at Target Field, and dropped the ball, and had an email exchange with Stu on that. I was astounded at being called a hit because since I demoted myself to a AAA baseball moving to Las Vegas, McCoy was basically an infielder and probably had little business being in the outfield. Stu emailed me back and said that Greg Wong was the official scorer and ruled that it was a hit because the sun got in his eyes. Now, I'm curious, I guess there are a couple of points here. One is, leniency on outfielders not catching fly balls if they get their glove on. And the other one is, do you kind of figure out where the sun is in advance of the game?
Well, we just look to see if he flinches. Metrodome, we have roof, lights, everything else. We talked about this in New York, and the consensus is if the sun prevents, screws a guy up, we're not going to give an error. If you don't give an error, you get a hit. This is the Andy Hawkins no-hitter in 1990, which he lost 4-0 in Chicago. Jim Leyritz dropped the fly ball that he should have caught. 3 runs scored. The inning would have been over. I don't remember, Daniel, though, I ever expressed transformation. I'm thinking, well, now Andy Hawkins is only 1 out instead of 4 outs away from a no-hitter because the Yankees are going to lose this. The next fly ball was hit out to Robin Ventura, hit it off to Jesse Barfield. Barfield fought the sun, went down to a knee, put off the glove, and went off, and Bob Rosenberg called that an error. If I ever said anything about it, it wasn't that I was unhappy because that preserved the no-hitter until some records committee came along and changed it. But it was just, normally, if the sun messes up an outfielder, it's going to get called a hit, and did Rosie change, do it differently? That's the only thing I can remember. If you can't see it, you can't catch it. Yeah, Al Kaline said you should never lose a fly ball in the sun because you should line it up. If the sun's there, you angle it. But we talked about that. If balls get messed up because of sunlights or anything else, there won't be an error on it.
My recollection was you may have said that they never call those errors, but maybe that's a little bit too strong. I'm not sure that's what
you said. Well, they only call it there.
But anyway, we've had that discussion on it and on the sun and so forth, so I appreciate that.
Something recent. R.A. Dickey, everyone's heard about, and he had a, turned out to be a one hitter, and David Wright clearly made an error in the first inning. And any Met fans would be aware of this. And the Mets appealed it. And I want to hear your take on it, but my thinking is I know that if Major League Baseball had overruled the umpire's call, that would open the can of worms, and I think that was probably one of the major reasons why they stay with it. No? Stu?
I think it was a good call.
I agree.
As a hit?
Upton was a hitter, fast runner, 2-3 hopper down the third baseline. If he goes to backhand with his glove, that's going to add another second to him making the transfer of the throw. I think he felt that was his only way of getting it. We just had to play a target field the other day. You see him at second base behind the bag, bare hands it. That's the only chance he had to get the runner. He throws it away, it was probably going to be a hit, but he threw it on a target. I think it was the right call.
I just saw the replay, it looked to me like a
runner. But did you see where the runner was down the line? And
the fact he was a fast runner, and knowing that third baseman, that was his thought. This is my only play opportunity to get this guy.
Has Major League Baseball ever overruled an umpire in a situation like that? I'm not curious.
A score. It came up in 2008 when Bob Webb called a hit for one of the LaRoche brothers in the fifth inning off Matthew that turned out to be the only thing. And that went, and that goes to a full panel. They got together to look at it together. They wanted a collaborative decision. The AFL and Bob Webb's call, I thought that was a good call, too. The review system hasn't been around that long. No hitter has never been created by that. I've got on my webpage an article I did on official scores of no hitter. And Bob Broom, I've got a headline that says Broom pitches one hitter, and it was a no hitter. And that was back in 1917 when nobody even knew what the official scores call was until the next day.
Another thing on that call, I was curious as to whether the Mets questioned the call immediately. My guess is they didn't question it until after the game, after no one else got a hit.
Well, even David Wright said it should have been an error because it was the first inning and nobody knew that he was going to give up, not hit.
Yeah.
First of all, if it's a hit in the first inning, it's a hit in the ninth inning. Scoreboard doesn't matter. Teams don't matter. The Mets only complained after the game. Next, please.
This is a comment on the half an error less than 30, 40 years ago. I'm thinking about the Washington Nationals. Last year, Adam LaRusse was out practicing the whole year with an injury, and Washington was near the bottom of the fielding statistics. This year, LaRusse's been back, and I've seen him make all sorts of pickups and everything, and Zimmerman's errors are down, and so is Brett Desmond, too. Culprits last year, so I really think that is a big factor. And also another factor, it would be possibly the gloves. I'm sure probably a little better than they were 30, 40 years ago.
Hi, I just want to ask about there was a game when Larry Walker played for the Expos where he caught a fly ball and he gave the ball to a fan. The problem was it was only the second out. I'm sure you remember that. I'm not sure that may have led to a run or a runner advancing or something like that. Do you score that in error or in error?
Yeah, that's the one mental, one of the very few mental mistakes you can give an error for.
Yeah.
Same thing if like a first baseman takes a throw at first and thinks the third out, is runner on third, he rolls the ball back to the mound. For our third score, you can give them an error for that mental mistake.
That's actually spelled out in the rule books.
Yeah. Okay, thank you.
Wendy Claire, my record fan graphs, among other places, and I wrote a couple stories in the offseason proposing some rule changes for what are now called, what are now blown save wins, right? So the closer comes in, blows the save, gets the win, trying to get rid of that. and have the win, which we all know doesn't really matter, but to the extent it matters, have the win revert to a different pitcher. And there are a number of ways of doing this, but you know, a number of people said, why can't scores just treat it like you would treat a situation where the starter doesn't go more than 5 innings? So I'm kind of curious to get your guys' thoughts on how difficult that would be. I mean, if the rule were changed to leave it up to the scorer's discretion as to who ought to get the win in that situation.
There's one spot where we can pick the winner, and that's what I talked about earlier, when the starter doesn't go five, that team is in the lead then and remains in the lead the rest of the game. And if there's wording in the rule book to help, and but in a situation where a guy comes in late in the game and gives up runs and then the team goes ahead again, I mean, that wouldn't be any different if the rule was changed. But again, we're not the rules committee.
If the rule were changed to say...
Well, we already have that possibility once. We could do it in that situation, too, if that rule were like that.
If there were multiple potential
winners. Yeah, well, first of all, Wendy, I am with you. If we could change the save rule, I'd love to. I guess if they gave us that discretion, it would just be one more thing to do. I wouldn't be against it.
Do you think it would be like the situation?
Well, my opinion is that the save rule should be called the didn't totally shit the bed rule. It's kind of a long acronym. Call it a vulture. There is one other possibility, and I know all the games I've ever... Yeah, what does that spell? All right, Matt Gaff's got a few of those. I'd love to see the save rule change. One other possibility where you might have to pick a winner, and all the games I've ever been to, I've seen it only once, and that's even though a pitcher is in the game for that team, when his team takes the lead for good, and we're talking about a reliever, if the pitcher was brief and ineffective, and the subsequent pitcher was more effective, you don't. So if somebody comes in and gives up a couple of runs, gets the final out of the inning, the game's either tied or his team's behind, and his team takes the lead for good, and another pitcher comes in. I was at a game in St. Louis in 1975, when Mike Marshall for the Dodgers got the save, or got the win instead of Jim Brewer. That's for everybody. One thing they changed in 2007, you can get the old 3-inning save by just finishing the game, doesn't matter what the lead is. It just came up recently, something that Dave Morrell was complaining about. We don't really have a problem with that, because guys aren't racking up the 62s like K-Rock did. You know, those are the one-inning wonders. But it used to be until 2007, we'd have to decide if the pitcher was effective enough if he got that 3-inning save. And they've taken that requirement off, and that's helpful to us because, let me ask you, if a guy gives up 2 earned runs in 3 innings and protects a 14-2 lead, is he effective? And we can debate that. Sure, he's effective. He didn't challenge the lead. On the other hand, that's the 6.67 ERA. So that was one. I'm glad they got rid of that little requirement, because that could put up an official score on the spot. But I think some of the stuff you're talking about, yeah, I think it's just like picking a winner if the starter doesn't go five. Yeah, because you can handle that longer.
This is about a rule that has changed with time, and I wonder if you agree with me that it was better the old way. In Game 4 of the 1941 World Series, which I remember probably better than you do, Mickey Owen was charged with an error because he failed to handle the third strike on what would have been the third out of the game. That was the rule at the time, and reasonable, I guess, because had he caught the ball and it was catchable, he would have been credited with a putout. In more recent years, I don't know when they started this, but they have been calling that a pass ball, I guess because the same thing happened in another situation would be a pass ball.
The rule of change in 1954 changed that play from E2 to DB.
It's the way the rule's written, and we're just doing what we're told to do by this little book.
Oh, I understand. And I've got this little book here from 1941 that we can look at after. And I'll show you what it read like then.
But in terms of
a pass ball was considered each base.
You're not using that old rule of winning over the twin teams, are you? No wonder the twins get different stats from everybody else.
And
if
what we now call strikeout wild pitch, we strike out an E1.
Yeah. By the way, in that park where I sit in the press box, I can't see the left field corner. A little bit of it. At RFK, where I sat, I couldn't see a pretty large piece of the right field corner. And Clem Connolly, who's in the room somewhere, maybe not, he was here a minute ago, oh, there he is, hiding. He said that at that time he knew that the Washington right fielders were going to lead the league in fielding percentage because they weren't going to get any errors in the corner. So I couldn't see them. And the first year, 05, for the first month and a half or 2 months, there was no TV, so I had no replay. And in April, the Marlins were in town, the Florida Marlins were in town, April of 05, and there was a play that went by first base, and I called it a hit, and the guy was apoplexic about it, wanted an error on his first baseman, and I said, show me a replay, and we'll talk about it. And he said, what? I can show you a replay. I said, exactly, go sit down.
We've got 7 minutes and 4 people. I don't think
I'll try to make this quick. One of you mentioned a base runner being hit by a batted ball, which triggered something. Has a no-hitter ever been broken up at any level of pro ball because of that? And if so, does the official score have the right to say not a base hit?
No, we go by the rules. There's a few other funny rules. Jordan Spreckman of New York, this wasn't involving a no-hitter, but if an infielder fields the ball and they put out a runner before he gets to the next base or returns to his previous base, even if it's not a force, there's no hit on that. So the rule book's not always fair. That might happen sometime. That'd be a wild way to lose a no-hitter. My one of the no-hitters I like was Howard Emke, who had, and this kind of goes to what Gil's point was, the guy who looked like he doubled, and they appealed at first base, and he was called out on appeal, so there's no hit. And he had a no-hitter preserved that way. And that's a fine, just fine no-hitter by me.
It's about one of the most bizarre plays I've ever seen in baseball. Maybe some people saw it in the 80s with Lloyd Mosby on first. He stole second, but the catcher stole into center field. Mosby got up, didn't know where the ball was, turned around, saw the center fielder with the ball, came back to first. Center fielder picked the ball, threw the ball away. Mosby got up, got to second again. Is the catcher divot with an error, first of all? When you encounter a play like that, I mean, it's not covered there. What do you do?
There's something in the rule book, playing rule book, about running the bases in reverse order.
Yeah, but that's if you're trying to confuse them. I mean, he was confused.
He was totally on.
You can't get a stolen base if you don't actually get to second. So when he went back to first, no stolen base. And he went to second only when the ball got thrown away, so still no stolen base.
But is there an error to the catcher?
No, he's an error to center fielder.
Okay.
As I understand it, in charge of an error if the fielder should make the play with ordinary efforts. Is Brett Gardner's ordinary effort the same as El Paso's or
no, it's an average player at that position. So you have to interpret.
We get that all.
All the time, but this guy's not normally our right fielder. That doesn't matter. He's being judged against the normal right. We have to judge Delvin Young against the normal left
fielder.
I've got in DC. I've got infielders playing left field. I've got catchers playing center field. Don't talk to me about
that. And they're all judged by an objective standard.
And a pitcher playing center field. So. That's Rick Ankiel, in case you care.
Yes, just a question on, are there stories you could tell about particular players complaining about scoring decisions you've made, and players who are notorious for that, Wayne Boggs have that reputation. I don't even know if it's true. What can, just give us some juicy stories.
Okay. I have to. Quick Yankees game in the Metrodome a few years ago. Justin Morneau hits one of the gap in right center. I believe it was a radio playing center field, went to pick it up on the warning track, slipped and fell down. At this point, Morneau was kind of coasting in the second. He saw Abreu fall down, so now he takes off the third. Now Abreu is laying, sitting on the ground. He flips the ball to Cabrera in right field to throw, try to throw it in. Well, he throws it over Cabrera's head. And so now, Morneau's kind of coasting in the third, and the Scotty Elder, third base coach, waves him in. So I call it a triple. Can't penalize Abreu for falling down, but he advanced from third to home on what I call the throwing error. After the game, Billy Smith was in the Twins' assistant GM, walked through the press box and says, double two base error. 5 minutes later, the Twins PR guy comes up, hey, the guys downstairs think it's an inside the park home run. I go down and talk to Ryan Gardner, and he explains to me why they thought it should be an inside the park home run. He said, you know, I don't really give a shit, but I want my player to know I got his back. And besides, we've only got 27 fucking home runs. We need every home run we can get. And he said, get out of here.
In the minor leagues, where I am now in Carolina League, I had one major league affiliation that was there in that city for 6 years, and I hope I never, ever see them again. I won't tell you who it is. But you're not telling me that. But for a couple of years, they had a hitting coach there who every night wanted to complain about a call. Every damn night. And one night, I was tired. I worked a day job. The alarm's going off early. I'm at the ballpark at night. I was tired. I wanted to go home. And this guy spent 10 minutes telling me why this ball should have been a hit. He kept going on, that's a knock in the big leagues. There should be a knock here. Blah, blah, blah. I said, it's, you know, I finally just shut up. You know, I stood there and let, see, maybe he'd wind his way down. But he said, finally, the thing that got me mad was, this one hit could be the difference between my guy hitting 299 and 300. And if he's hitting 300, he's got a better attitude. And if he's got a better attitude, he has a better chance to make the big leagues. And I went off on this guy. And I won't use all the words here that I used. It's the only time in my career that I've actually done this. But I told him that it wasn't my bleeping job to get this guy to the big leagues. It was his bleeping job. Do your bleeping job and stop bleeping bothering me. And I turned around and stormed off. I went and drove home. And I was mad all the way home. And I just figured the next morning I was going to get a call from the league president. Never heard a word, and that coach never talked to me again, so I did my job.
Just one more quick one. So, R.A. Dickey, when he pitched for the Twins, a knuckleballer, throws one right off the ground when Redman was catching. I call it a wild pitch. After the game, Redman said, oh, I should have had that because it caused Dickey to run. So Pierre guy comes up the press box, but you go down and take a look at it again on our video. So I'm down there looking at the Twins video, and Gardner walks by and says, what are you looking at? Well, Redman thinks it should have been a fastball. I call it a wild pitch. He says, he's a knuckleball pitcher. Of course it was a wild pitch. Get out of here. I never had a complaint from Gardner, some of his coaches, but never from Gardner.
Our time is up, I'm afraid, but I... Well, in closing, I'd like to thank the panel, David, Greg, Stu. Thank you all. Really added to the discussion. Do you have any other questions for the panel?